the Incomparable Podcast, number 22, January 2011.
Recorded live in front of a studio audience.
Of one.
It's Friday night. It's 9 p.m. Pacific.
Do you know where your children
are? And you know what we're doing, because we're party animals? We're all drinking tea. Like the English drink tea.
In the Incomparable Studio.
That wasn't even an English accent. It was just...
It just sounded kind of pompous.
I want to talk about... I want to talk about Stephen Fry.
Okay.
And Mycroft Holmes.
All right.
And so, Mark Gatiss.
I don't want to talk about any of that.
So let me explain what's happening here. This is the Incomparable Podcast. I am Jason Snell, apparently your host, because I've been declared so by Dan Morin. So to explain, we are here in San Francisco.
There is too much.
Let me sum up. Normally when we do these podcasts, we are scattered across the four corners of the earth, or at least of the United States. Do it all with the magic of Skype. And that's why this podcast is so very wrong, because we are all in a little room where they turned off the air conditioning and we're all slowly going to suffocate.
Jason, can I ask a question?
Recording this together.
Why is this night different from all other nights?
There are enough
people in the room who get that. So
I get it.
I know you do. I'm pointing at our audience.
Yes, we do have an audience of one who's taking up the oxygen. It's going to be like the cold equations. Actually, at some point, somebody's going to have to die, and we're going to have to shoot them out the door of the podcast room just in order to keep enough oxygen.
This time on The Incomparable, we slowly kill off members of the cast.
Who will survive?
Yes.
That would be a great episode. So joining me here, if it isn't already obvious, in this room today, locked in, it's like a locked room mystery. The mystery is, what are we talking about?
Dun, dun, dun.
And our suspects are myself, Jason Snell, also known as Professor Plum. Across from me is Serenity Caldwell, Miss Scarlet.
Hiding.
Next to her is Glenn Fleischman, Colonel Mustard.
I'm holding a pipe. There is no pipe.
There is no pipe.
The pipe is a lie.
Next to me is Dan Morin, Mr. Green.
I'd see. Oh, okay. Fine. Mr. Green it is.
And our audience is holding a candlestick.
And we're in the podcast room.
Does that make you – so wait. Our lone audience member could be Mr. Body.
He is. He's the unnamed victim, Mr. Body, who is here with us.
Who has a name.
TV's Lex Friedman. See, this is great because we have laughter, but it's not a laugh track. It's just a guy.
But he laughs every time the same way. That's the amazing thing.
It's like the first season of Sports Night.
Okay, so Glenn, you said you wanted to talk about Stephen Fry.
I always want to talk about Stephen Fry because he is possibly the most interesting person in the world, not just
himself. He doesn't listen to this, Glenn.
This podcast is over.
All right. Well, we could tweet it to him. In any case, so Stephen Fry has been tweeting that he will be playing Mycroft Holmes in an upcoming – second Sherlock Holmes movie with Robert Downey Jr.
That's his whole name.
We call
Robert
him Robert
Downey Jr.
Not, I yes, just his friends call him Junes.
June. RDG. So
RDG. The G is for Junior.
The G is silent.
Exactly. So Stephen Fry as Mycroft. Mark Gatiss played Mycroft, Sherlock's older brother, in the recent BBC adaptation that we all talked about.
Right, the Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss.
If I was smart, I would look up who played him in the Jeremy Brett series.
I don't remember the actor's name.
Older guy.
There's episodes.
Charles something.
So he was Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever, which was a terrible Bond. I've seen all the Bonds. And let me tell you, Diamonds Are Forever, that was the movie. Is that not the movie where Sean Connery came back after departing?
No. You're thinking of Never Say Never Again.
No. But he came back. He quit. And then George Lazenby did On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And then they threw a lot of money at Sean Connery to come back and do one last Bond
movie. No. He filmed like five or six up front. He left. Lazenby came in. After Lazenby was Moore. And then there's a one-off, which is not – it's one of those ones that like the Broccoli family did not own the rights to.
Oh, the Casino Royale.
No. There's also Never Say Never Again.
Never Say Never Again. Well, which
is the one where he comes back.
Thunderball.
Right. And he's got gray hair. It's Sean Connery. And it's like 1980. And it's got like Kim Basinger in it.
Oh, my God.
I don't think that's the – you know, now at a risk of destroying our computer. I don't think that's the Bond timeline. Well, sorry, while we're talking about James Bond over here, this is going to be like the 8 degrees of parentheses
podcast. There's one
podcast.
More. There's one yes. more. Mystery Science Theater 3000 uncovered a movie made by Sean Connery's brother in which he plays James Bond's brother, a man who can control people with his mind. And they bring,
that sounds awesome.
And they bring, I think it's the guy who plays Blofeld, also is in this terrible, terrible movie in which – and it opens with the villain projecting a movie on a nude back of a woman because that's apparently what villains do. They use women as a kind of furniture.
Or movie screens.
Well, it's kind of furniture. Not unlike Macworld Expo.
So just to be clear here and to show that Dan Morin is wrong again, Her Majesty's Secret Service was starred George Lazenby. Yeah. It was released in 1969. It didn't go so well, and they said, please, please, Sean Connery, come back to be James Bond, which is why he appeared in Diamonds Are Forever in 1971 with the guy who was Mycroft on Sherlock Holmes. Terrible movie, and that was his last movie until he did the Never Say Never Again kind of contractual obligation thing. And then Roger Moore came in.
Well, so what do you know?
You know, did you isn't
wrong,
that something?
Dan.
So actually it was Connery, Lazenby, Connery, then Moore.
I have it on good authority from a person who interviewed Sean Connery on multiple occasions that he is a not very smart gentleman, even in his prime.
Does he need to be?
I dispute that.
We have a great day ahead of us, comrades.
I'm a Russian
submarine.
What was
the terrible movie that Sean Connery did?
Zardoz.
Yeah. Zardoz, okay.
Which one? Zardoz is a good answer.
Highlander 2.
Zardoz was the one I was thinking of,
Zardoz,
but I couldn't remember it was Zardoz or Zardo.
It starts with a Z and ends with a Z, and there's lots of Zs in the middle.
There's also Highlander 2, The Money Collector Ring.
Yes.
Well,
in multiple
versions. Is that an actual subtitle?
No, it's not. That was Highlander 2. We're bringing him back from the dead so he can make some more money in a terrible Highlander. Highlander films.
I liked that in the first Highlander movie, he is the only actual Scottish person in the movie, and he plays an Egyptian.
And you have heard
Christopher Lambert has a terrible Scottish accent.
And you have heard who's the late night host who was Mr. Wick on
Craig Ferguson.
Craig Ferguson has a whole rant about the fact that they get a Scotsman. He goes to Scotland in the movie Highlander and then does a Spanish fake Egyptian accent. The only movie that Sean Connery was ever in which he should have actually used a Scots accent.
Like, he doesn't use a different accent. He still sounds like...
I'm from Egypt and I'm thousands of years old, Highlander.
That's his voice.
How is it possible that I have more control over this podcast when you're on Skype than when you're in the room with me?
Because it's easier for us to take away the mic without delays. We can't talk over each other
when we're on Skype.
And the beauty
we're
of it is
scared.
Very... Then I can cut you out and here I can't do anything.
No.
You just talk and
you're
talk.
All at our mercy.
So Stephen Fry...
Stephen Fry, wonderful actor.
Where were you
so
going
short
with
and that? Stout as opposed to tall and thin?
I was just thinking about – I just like Mycroft Holmes.
Because Mark Gatiss
– like,
I like bikes.
I like Mycroft.
I'm just talking about Mycroft, ladies.
Look, shut your mouth.
Man, that Mycroft is one bad
– Shut your mouth.
I like corpulent detectives who sit in comfortable chairs. Is there anything
that is a sub-genre.
That?
That's
really
like
is.
Scott McNulty liking historical like fiction that begins with the letter W. I don't know.
It's set in New York in 1821.
There are many, many detectives in this category, and I will defend that. I'll defend the indefensible.
All right. So
name them.
So apropos of Stephen.
I have a list of two so far.
Stephen Fry is Mycroft Holmes.
Stephen Fry
is Mycroft Holmes in this. Interesting. Because Sherlock Holmes is in the public domain, we have these two franchises of Sherlock Holmes going on simultaneously, a film and a TV.
You don't want to start me down that path. Sherlock Holmes is not in the public domain precisely, and it is the most boring story I could possibly tell. So I merely refer you.
Is some of it in the public domain?
Sort of. There's an issue about, oh, God, don't get me started. There's a New York Times article that spells it up marvelously. If listeners can use the Google.
Tell us about wireless standards.
Me too. I'm not going there.
The IEEE.
Explain in 140 characters or less. Go.
Well, you see. No, actually, there's an interesting story there. There is an interesting story. I will get an interesting story out of this. God damn it. I swore. Now we have to use the explicit rating. Did you mark
yes.
that? So the interesting story is
dear
that
listener.
What happens is there is a literary figure such as, I don't know, Agatha Christie or Arthur Conan Doyle or someone who writes a series of interesting novels and TV shows, whatever. And then they die and their spouse remarries. And the person they remarry is often a lawyer who is very good at exploiting the rights of dead people's literary properties.
That in and of itself could be a TV show.
Mm-hmm. That would be a great TV show.
No, that McConaughey,
Would that be like Murder, She Wrote, and then he died, and then she wrote,
Murder, She Posthumously Cashed In Upon.
Wow.
That's the title of the podcast.
You know, Angela Lansbury's been needing some work lately.
Yes. Well, ever since she married George Orwell,
that was a match made in
George
Orwell. Room 101,
our fiction.
This is the worst room in the world right now, isn't it?
It's really,
isn't it?
Really warm.
And this week,
drinking tea.
Are we in the? I feel like we're in the box, in prison, like when they put you in solitary.
No, it's like
I thought you meant like on Homicide, where Frank Pendleton is going to come
maybe
in.
Maybe a little bit.
I know you did it.
It's the slowly boiling frog.
That's the pod again. To get back to the initial concept of this podcast, gradually each of us will die, leaving only Lex alive.
That's incomparable for his own.
That's Murder by Death. This is the plot. Is Murder by Death, isn't it? You know, Peter Falk and Truman Capote.
So Stephen Fry.
I saw this. No, I know Serenity was not yet born by some time, but when I was, this is long before you were around. But my mom took me and a bunch of friends. We saw Murder by Death for a birthday party. Took all my friends out to see a great movie. Peter Falk, Truman Capote.
Was there a hidden ironic message in that?
And there are corpulent detectives in that film.
Yes, the name of this episode, The Corpulent Detective.
The Curious Case of the Corpulent
Detective.
I've
got you all wrapped around my finger.
In color.
Will be gone first.
Was there more about Stephen Fry, or were you at the end
of
that?
That was all he had.
He was good friends with Douglas Adams.
So wait a second. You started and said, Stephen Fry, an interesting story. He's going to be Mycroft.
End of line.
I have a friend in Rome,
Wow.
Dan Morin's head has hit the table, ladies and gentlemen.
This is what happens when we don't prepare. I'd like to apologize to everybody already for this. But
this sounds like one of the other podcasts I used to do where my friend and I would just sit online and riff for 20 minutes.
I used to record these into cassette tapes when I was a kid. By myself.
Note to self.
He used to do the voices, though.
Voices of Jason Snow.
Yeah, I don't know how he knew, but
it's time travel thing.
Everybody remember the was it Boy Talk in the Home Alone movies or something like that? It's like the little handheld recorder.
Oh, that he used to like simulate the mobster
the
guys. And stuff.
I had the girly version of this.
Was it called Girl Talk?
Girl Talk. It was called Girl Talk, and it was terrifying. And I got it from a friend as
What made it different? Was it just pink?
It was purple, actually.
We're gonna fix all of this in post.
Oh yes.
Oh my god.
To get back to the point I was originally
Stephen
making.
Stephen Fry.
He's great. He's very talented. You know what's a good movie? No, the movie that he's in that I really love in a desperate attempt to get this on some sort of track is V for Vendetta.
Yeah, it's a serious role, right? I mean, pretty much. I've seen it, and it's
but he plays a comedian.
He does have a little funny Monty Python.
He's a comedian who is sort of protecting his private life and shields Natalie Portman, who I know is near and dear to Dan.
He shields her by hiding her under a bed because secret forces in a totalitarian government would never look under a bed. It's remarkable thing.
Never,
it's the
ever.
Best he could come up with.
I know.
And then he's taken away and executed, basically. So,
but the secret forces do not
spoiler
actually.
Spoiler horn. Spoiler horn.
Yes.
That was sad.
That is the best spoiler horn ever. That was like the spoiler quack. Spoiler duck. So V for Vendetta, the Wachowski brothers who did The Matrix, and then they made those terrible, terrible sequels to The Matrix.
No sequels.
Right.
Keanu says there's two more coming.
No, that was debunked. That was debunked.
Oh,
But that movie, they didn't actually direct it. They produced it, and they had like the guy who was their second director.
Yeah, James McTeague?
Yeah. Mm. And I know some people don't like that movie. I love that movie.
I think it's quite good.
I think that's and it's based on a comic book, Alan Moore comic book, but it's not a superhero-y kind of comic book.
You know, here's a funny thing. Alan Moore didn't like the movie.
No. To be fair, Alan Moore doesn't like – he specifically requested his name be taken off every movie made Well, I mean, to be fair, did anyone else see League of Extraordinary Gentlemen? Because that's terrible.
Speaking of Sean Connery.
Oh, my God.
And it all goes back around.
Africa will never let me die.
That's Vendetta is a fun movie, though. I mean, fun. I say
it's
fun in the.
I would not like to see your basement.
But It's fun in the most basic word. It's enjoyable. It's a good enjoyable movie, yeah. And it talks.
And I think you can read it. I mean, I think at the time the way to read it and the way it was coded was about a criticism of like the Bush administration and the war in Iraq. But I think on a broader level, just viewing it again as a movie about a totalitarian state, I think there's something for everyone in there, right? I think that
little girls, totalitarianism,
you know, yeah, that's
pedophile
right.
John
Hurt as essentially as Big Brother. I really like that movie.
Well, there are a couple of lovely little segs in it too, like the 10-minute. I don't remember the actress who plays her, but the Valerie sequence where she's reading
lovely.
The letters and
– that's directly from the – I mean that's presented very well from the comics too. Yeah, that's one of the
I remember reading the comic about a few months after I saw the film, but I only read it online and I think it was only available in like bits and pieces pirated.
It's beautiful and yeah, that is so touching. Although the one part of the movie where I really kind of went, damn, is the whole, hey, Natalie Portman, you're going to be tortured and we're going to tell you that you're dying and it's all a fake out. And
surprise.
I still don't know. Every once in a while I think about that and I
– Was it really a fake out or –
Well, but I mean she wasn't complicit in it, but it's – you know, it's kind of creepy because she accepts it. Like she goes – she's mad briefly and then she feels liberated. And I'm like, is this a vindication of psychological torture?
She's sort of brainwashed, right, in
yeah.
a way. And
yeah,
yet
absolutely.
I mean that's one of the interesting things about the movie.
And then she has her freedom because he's brainwashed her by breaking her through torture. Oh, but he never breaks her. She never confesses.
Right. He picks her.
That's a good 1984 callback too.
Right.
I mean I watched the movie – actually when I watched V for Vendetta, I was drawn back to John Hurt in 1984, which is
right.
I mean that movie is – that is a freaky, wonderful, underrated film and it's very authentic to the book. And there's a ton of callbacks including the giant screen in V for Vendetta as a callback to 1984.
Right, right. No, that's – I mean
– You already said. I'm sorry.
It's interesting. The 1984 is an interesting example of a book that is considered great literature and kids read it in school. And you know you can't not call that a sci-fi book, except I think people don't because they're afraid to categorize it as that.
There's a lot of great –
It was written in 1948.
Right.
And it's
mm-hmm. There's a lot of great thought-provoking literature that is you know technically science fiction but is very often represented under
anybody.
The guise. Well, I'm thinking again you know along similar lines, Fahrenheit 451,
yeah, that's my thought.
Which is
right.
not a book that I love but I think is an interesting book. It's not my favorite Bradbury work. I think he has done better work elsewhere, but it's the one that's mostly popular. And I actually got into a discussion with someone recently about that because, I mean, it's very similar to 1984 in some themes, but one of my friends is like, oh, Ray Bradbury's crazy. He said Fahrenheit 451 isn't a book about censorship when clearly – and I said, well, I just reread it. It isn't about censorship really. It's about people, the population willfully – becoming sort of anesthetized to mm-hmm. like what's going on around them. They don't want to know anything. They're censoring themselves.
And the antithesis of people coming and memorizing books and passing them on orally. And
right. Which is – it's again, it's a book that I find more interesting in its ideas than in its execution.
Although I will say that I love the – when was the movie made? In like the 70s, 80s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They tried to get a remake for years off the ground and it never took off.
That film was one of the first – science fiction related films I saw after Star Wars, and it stuck in my mind. It's one of the many films that I saw on beta tape, and that film in particular stuck with me over and over. I don't think I read the actual book until much later. There are certain images, like images of that the monorail or whatever, the high train. I just remember the giant, like the architecture and things like that. And it's a very striking film, even if it's not entirely solid.
I haven't seen it.
I have not either. I've read the book.
I read the book in high school, yeah.
I reread it a couple of years ago because I was interested to see. I read some other Bradbury stuff and really liked it and was just sort of like, oh, I should go back and reread Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah, he's a really good
he
writer.
He is actually a fantastic writer. Yeah. And if there's one book I would recommend, it's Something Wicked This Way Comes,
yes, that,
which is a great book.
Spill is about childhood and it spends – chills up my spine every time I read it.
I read that I had just moved into my after college, like my first apartment. I didn't have like a bed yet. I remember I was sleeping on like a mattress on the floor reading this book. And it really is, it's not scary, but it's creepy in like a really effective way. And it's just, it's his prose is honestly lyrical really when it gets down to it in a way that I don't think a lot of people write. And I've read a couple other things by him since time, and I like them. I go back and forth, but that one in particular stuck in my mind as like It's so evocative.
There's I forget how good the movie is. There's a movie adaptation of it.
1981. It's a TV movie with like Jonathan Pryce, I think.
And, and Jason Robards. Now, they think it's uneven, but Jason Robards is a fine actor, and he's very moving as the father. I mean, it's a father worried about losing his son, the son wanting to grow up faster than he could. I mean, Ray Bradbury, he always fought and fights the science fiction label because he thinks of himself as writing the great American novel or short story over and over again, and he uses the least amount of fantasy or science fiction horror elements that he can to convey the emotional reality of what he's saying. We got very serious.
He also writes if you ever get a chance to read his essays, he has written some fabulous essays. I have a collection of his essays, including at least one about, I think, about Apple, where he talks a bit about Apple computers, and I think likens them in some ways to Disney. He was friends with Walt Disney at some point and had helped with some of the like Disney World planning or what have you. And
there's a cryogenic crypt awaiting him on his demise.
that got macabre. Thanks.
Wow.
His short stories are also very brilliant. S's for Space is one of the first science fiction books I ever checked out from the library. I must have been like 6 or 7. And most of it was very much over my head and very scary. But I kept that book from the library for about 6 months and paid a whole lot of overdue fines out of my allowance. But it was my favorite book, and I read it over and over and over for at least a year.
I was reading some short story collection by him recently, and I found it – I don't know. I was a little disappointed because I found a lot of the stories very kind of hit you over the head with the with the symbolism.
Some of them, I mean, yeah.
Because there's one that's, for example, basically about – what if there's this planet of aliens and like Jesus came down in like a spaceship or something, and then everybody people ignore him basically. I mean, it's kind of veiled, but it's very thinly veiled, and so it was a little bit. He's still a great writer, I think, but it's not as, I don't know. I found it a little too hit me over the head with the message. Well, and I think that's really where it's best, and what sci-fi does best. It makes you
in my story, Jesus is a robot.
It makes you reevaluate things.
Robo Jesus.
Robo Jesus.
I was trying
to do Phil Lamar there, and I didn't.
On a completely tangential note to that, I mean,
are we two tangents away now?
I need to step back to Ray Bradbury because I was looking up the Fahrenheit 451 movie, which was made in 1966, directed by Francois Truffaut.
Oh, my God.
Which I didn't – and starring Oscar Werner and Julie Christie, which I never really occurred to me.
Wow.
But Truffaut making – just talking about, influential directors making.
Who saw Solaris? Who saw the original
The original
Solaris?
I have not seen
it. It is a fascinating movie, partly because it includes long – it's a very stylistic film, but it is one of the most – disturbing things you can see because a lot of the things
the one that, without George Clooney.
The one
right?
without George Clooney. It's disturbing because it presents, it's all about simulacra and what is real, what is not real, and things being created from memory. But it's disturbing that the things that should be most disturbing are presented in a very ordinary fashion, such as they're orbiting this star, far from Earth, and there's sort of no explanation of the science and getting there, whatever. That's just they do that. But the fact that the star turns out to be an intelligent and creating life from their memories and so forth these people are presented as other actors. No, there doesn't need to be special effects. It's like his dead wife appears and he has to cope with that even though he knows she's a simulacrum. It's very psychologically disturbing in the middle of all this ostensible science fiction.
Isn't it like 5 hours long or something?
Yeah, there's a scene where he's driving – the astronaut is driving from his – the Dacha or something into his – or Dacha to the city, and it goes on and
on. And it's in real time.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. You're like, this is 20 minutes of a man driving in a car, but it's sort of trying to, I think, be a simulation of
have you seen The Fountain? Has anybody seen The Fountain?
No. In the long series of things that Glenn has not finished, I've tried to watch The Fountain.
Huh.
All I know about The Fountain
I liked The Fountain. Although, I'm not sure whether I liked it or I appreciated what it was trying to do and which it failed at. But it is – Roger Ebert recently wrote an appreciation of it because Darren Aronofsky just directed – Black Swan.
Black Swan,
and then The Wrestler.
Mixed opinions about Black Swan. I haven't seen it.
I can't wait to see his follow-up, Wolverine. That's not a joke. He's directing the next Wolverine.
The thing I find,
but it's like that. The Fountain is similar in that way, where it's a I mean, it's three stories that are interlocked where it's the same guy and he's a conquistador working for Queen Isabella, and then he's a guy whose wife is Isabel and is dying of cancer, and then there's this astronaut and it's still Hugh Jackman. Again, see, Wolverine,
the
Aronofsky, and he's in the far future and he's on this tree spaceship that's going to the star, and
very beautiful.
And Ebert's piece is about how it's really, you know, the present day is the reality. The past story is the story that his wife is writing because she's a novelist. And then the future is she dies and he has to finish her novel, and he dreams that he's bringing her back to life on this spaceship. And it's beautiful, but it is slow and weird. And when you describe Solaris, I thought, you know, that's sort of like The Fountain. Although Sunshine, the Danny Boyle movie, is also slow and weird, and I'm not sure it makes sense.
It's more
but
a piece
I kind
of
liked
art
it. Yeah,
film.
I just thought of a great game you could play is summarize an incredibly complicated movie in one sentence that destroys all beauty and meaning in it. I think it would be a very interesting game.
That's a sad game.
Roger Ebert's thing, it's like, it's this very complicated. I'm sort of being
funny.
Hold on,
I can do this with American society.
A man in a mask decides to blow up Parliament.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that's a terrible movie.
That's good.
Yeah.
Rich guy likes his sled.
Oh,
that's
touching. Spoiler horn, everybody.
I think I'd be more like rich jerk just misses his slider.
That's right.
The thing that I've always found really curious about The Fountain, which I never saw, but I heard a lot about it technically because I had friends who were very sort of into the technical thing, is that all of the space effects in The Fountain and all of the really interesting kind of weird visual effects were all created by filming things splitting under a microscope.
Like oils and things.
So,
right?
Yeah, and putting oils, and so all there's like, I think there's a scene of universe exploding or something. Not exploding, but.
Well, yeah, it's, I think that's the whole like end with the tree and the
there's
light and the.
The
yeah.
game Osmos HD.
It's weird.
Osmos for the iPad actually reminds me of this movie. And I'm not kidding, because it's strange forms that seem alive moving back and forth and undulating.
Far out, man.
Stephen Fry.
he
is not in
that. So backing it up again. Any other books that you were assigned in school that are supposed to be great literature that are sort of don't tell anybody that it's actually science.
Brave New World.
Brave New World is the classic example.
I had
right?
a hard time getting through that.
No
Brave New World. Brave New
World
is also one of those that's high acclaimed literature and was
Aldous
really
Huxley
hard
really
to
just
read.
Want to justify
yeah.
doing a lot of drugs.
And its sequel was really hard to read too.
Brave New World.
It was so hard that I
braver,
didn't try.
Braver,
yes.
braver New World.
Brave New World with a vengeance.
Well, I don't even remember what
Cowardly
it was called.
Cowardly Old World.
Does anybody actually remember
Brave New World 2.
Yes.
The Worlding.
Electric.
The Worlding.
Electric Boogaloo. It's all Electric Boogaloo.
Moby Dick. Moby Dick is science fiction.
Yeah.
Giant Whale.
I'd make that.
Telepathic. Well,
by that logic, we're sort of connected to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Mm-hmm. SpongeBob? Also science fiction?
Sure.
There are no talking sponges.
The man is a sponge.
Jules Verne basically is the inventor of science fiction, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
I mean, essentially.
Yeah, one could argue he's a time traveler because he really had way too much knowledge of the future.
Well, he wrote the book on it, right?
He created the future.
Mm-hmm. Or perhaps everybody read the books and was like, we need to move towards this kind of a society.
No, that's a forward chronological theory. It doesn't work.
Did you get passed a note from our studio audience?
I did, and it read, I think he was content. Are you contending that George Orwell is the other creator of science fiction because Animal Farm had talking animals?
Talking animals.
I think you could just argue that George Orwell is the forerunner of the downfall of modern cinema as a result, because if you've seen the Garfield movie.
George Orwell is responsible.
George Orwell is responsible.
Or the Garfield sequel, A Tale of Two Kitties.
What?
That has two puns in the title. Which is just because tail is T A I L
of two kitties
and kitties, yeah.
Have you seen?
I don't go to movies anymore.
Have you seen Zombieland? We spoiled Zombieland on a previous podcast, but the best line, Bill Murray. I'm not going to spoil anything, but I'll say Bill Murray makes a cameo appearance, and at one point they ask him if he's had any regrets in his life, and he says, "No, well, maybe Garfield."
That isn't. Also, that is a fantastic movie.
Garfield.
Yeah, it's one of my
or Tale of Two Kitties.
No, both. both on my top 10
you
list.
You view them – really, it's one movie and they had to split it in two because it was too much
story
for one Garfield
movie.
Go back and
rewatch it.
And hey, look. Potential science fiction.
Beethoven Second.
Rewatch it. Beethoven Second.
It's like, well, I have not had a chance yet to read this article passed to us by a friend who sent some article about how the Star Wars prequels are actually really, really awesome. Trust
me.
Here
we go. We are now, it is now the Incomparable Podcast because
Star Wars
is
we're starting now, right?
I haven't read this article yet, but apparently there's this guy who really earnestly argues that the prequels were really George Lucas's finest work, and it's just like the self-delusion that must go into that is just – I find that fascinating.
Well, maybe he's on a type of drug that we just haven't discovered yet,
Dan. I would like that drug.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't like that drug.
We were talking about – but Stephen Fry. No, we were talking about
– Why is Stephen Fry not in
about,
the Star Wars
old movie serial that we're all supposed to watch for a future project for The Incomparable. And we were talking about how that was – it turns out that there was a show when I was a kid. You might have seen it. These people are too young. Called Cliffhangers. I don't know if you remember that, but it was an NBC show, and the idea was it was 3 20-minute segments in an hour, and it was 3 different stories. And it was, and they when the show began, it was like part 2 of the one story, and part 4, and part 5, and then every episode had a cliffhanger. And one of those is actually based on the short that we're supposed to watch. And I was talking, I think, maybe to Dan about this, and he said, well, you know, that was what George Lucas was getting at, was that kind of we're joining them in the middle of the action with episode 4. Unfortunately, he then felt compelled to make the first 3.
I mean, it went from being kind of like an interesting artsy, like, ah, you're in the middle, but there is no beginning or no ending.
Right.
And then into, but now there's a beginning, and it's terrible.
And it's not that good.
Here's a secret about beginnings and origin stories. They're not really that great. To tie into previous podcasts.
Yes.
I like origin stories.
I like orange in my stories, too.
I like Orangina stories.
Orange
stories about
Julius.
Orangina. I had a bottle of Orangina.
I grew up with Orange Julius. I loved that place.
Yeah.
That was just a guy on the street, right?
I hear Stephen.
Yeah. A little too much fake tan bronzer, going on.
I hear Stephen Fry is actually.
This is the podcast in which we mention Stephen Fry the most and never really talk about
him. Stephen Fry apparently built the Gutenberg press, a replica of it, a couple years ago for a TV series.
I'm not kidding.
I like that, like improbable facts about Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry also once ran around the entire world.
He's the strongest man in the world.
Stephen Fry.
He did build the Gutenberg press.
I watched his thing about it.
He didn't do it himself.
And not originally.
No, I mean, he went back in time.
We don't know that.
He was Johannes Gutenberg.
He is capable. Stephen Fry is the hardest working man.
That explains the similarities.
Can you prove he wasn't?
You know, Dan Morin has met Stephen Fry.
I am so jealous. I am.
He was a nice fellow.
So I guess I'm the guy who doesn't make it out of here alive.
Pretty much.
One man.
He's a very nice fellow. He's very pleasant. In fact, actually, one of a friend who knows him got him to sign a book for me, too. And so I got a nice personalized book.
You know, he wrote a Doctor Who episode that they never made.
Oh, what? I don't know about that.
Yeah.
What?
Russell Davis asked him to do a Doctor Who episode, and apparently he wrote a first draft. And it was going to cost – it was going to be for the end of the season, and it was going to cost a fortune, much like what happened with Neil Gaiman, actually. And so they said, well, we have to defer this to next year. And the story is that then they went back to Stephen Fry and he was like, you know, I don't have time to do another run at this.
It's like, while I'm on the phone with you, I'm filming 2 TV shows and traveling to Australia.
Yeah.
So I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
Well, reading the Russell Davies book about the writer's tale.
Yeah.
Which is on my desk.
Yes. A giant. Right. It cost $7,000 to send from Seattle to San Francisco.
How to own plane. The subtitle is How to Procrastinate While Doing a Multi-Million-Dollar TV Show.
How to write a book about not writing the TV show that you're being paid to write. But one of the things in it, there's some good technical detail in there. That's just interesting. If you want, you know, we watch enough TV to know about how some of the sci-fi stuff's made. And he talks about effect days, which I hadn't come up. And so he'll write a script and then it gets read by the production team and they send it to their effects house. And they'll be like, okay, well, this thing you want, this is going to be like 783 people days worth of time from our effects house. And our budget is for like 201 days, which will cost, you know, X hundreds of thousands of dollars. So you have to cut, you know, scenes and actions amounting to like 500 days worth of rendering time. So that's why sometimes Doctor Who, you're watching it and they're tooling along and it's like, we must make it across this gap and blow up that ship and whatever. Aha, we're there. Like, oh, well, I mean, that saved us $500,000.
This is time honored, right? Like, I mean, you know, there's the reason that all the Star Trek, you know, TV show episodes were on sound stages and they all looked suspicious. Or like the that one piece of California, like with the
oh,
big
Vasquez,
rocks.
Oh, Vasquez Rocks.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, which is the best spoof ever of that, or the best reference to that ever, is in the second Bill and Ted movie.
Yes.
They go there.
Although actually, I would argue that the new Star Trek reboot where they went back there to make it Vulcan was a great reference
yes.
to. It's like it's got
to
be in here. It's
oh,
a
it
Star Trek.
To.
It's got a gut.
It's
Vasquez
required.
Rock. I want to. I've never been there. I want to go there sometime just because.
And fight a Gorn.
Will you wear a red shirt or a yellow shirt?
I'll fight a Gorn and I'll be visited by the ghost of the first Slayer because Buffy the Vampire Slayer's episode where she has her dream
la,
vision
la,
thing.
La la, I haven't
was,
seen it. La la,
yeah, she has
season 3.
Oh, okay.
Spoilers.
I'm actually watching it now.
We'll have to do, we're going to have to do a Buffy retrospective
when we actually finish season three at some point.
That's right. Spoiler alert for the show that was off the air in 2003. But
I think that's okay.
It's not my fault.
It's okay. It is my favorite TV show of all time.
She was young. I was foolish. Between the two of us.
So classic. Well, it's got a silly title for the best show ever, but it is the best.
And it was on UPN. I mean,
well,
only
it was
for
on
two
WB
years.
Before that. The, only the two bad years at the end were on UPN.
Really?
The person who has not seen it is arguing with the two guys who have seen it.
No, the
she
first,
reads Wikipedia.
The first 5 years were on the WB.
Yeah.
And then they,
really?
And then they moved it for the last two disappointing years.
Was it before or after a show? Was it an 8 p.m. slot or a 9 p.m. slot?
That is way too specific.
It was a 9 p.m. slot for most of it. Or
then
was,
if I make
no,
the joke,
no.
It was probably past my bedtime.
No, it was an 8 p.m. slot because Angel was on after Buffy.
Oh, except it was still on WB. That did not. That never
that
left.
Never left.
Yeah.
No.
There was
wow.
Weird.
This is like the swerviest podcast ever.
If we'd only been drinking, it would have all made much more sense. But
yes.
In fact,
no. We've all.
I
been
recommend
drinking.
That
I don't
our.
Think,
oh, I think
listeners,
sorry,
we've all been drinking.
I recommend that our listeners drink before listening to the rest. Of
I
this
think you
podcast.
Should put a recipe at the outset of this. Please pour
for the incomparable martini.
Well, this is the incomparable. After Dark.
That was the
now
Stephen Fry
in a locked in a room.
Stephen Fry.
They're no longer locked in a room.
He had a TV
room,
show
Jason.
Called A Bit of Fry and Laurie. And at the end of each episode,
with Hugh Laurie, TV's Dr. House,
TV's
and
Hugh
one of our one of America's finest actors.
He plays.
He sing and it's lovely.
And he imitates a trumpet very convincingly.
Yes.
And they always serve a drink. What shall we order for the drink? And it's all I'll have the hat tricks. Like you take 3 pounds of dried ice shavings and arsenic, mix them together and shake. And then he shakes while Mr. Music plays. And that's what
I cannot believe that you brought it around to Stephen Fry again. There, that is.
I win
Glenn
this
is
podcast.
The king of the podcast.
I am amazed by that. No, it's funny. You mentioned the Doctor Who special effects, and I was just watching one of the commentary tracks of the fifth season of the Doctor Who, and there was actually a shot that it's in the Weeping Angels episode where there's the TARDIS follows the spaceship and the spaceship zooms off and the TARDIS follows it. And a funny thing happened. Stephen Moffat said, you know, that wasn't in the script and the guys at the special effects house wanted so badly to have the zooming spaceship and the TARDIS doing it that they just made it for free. So occasionally you'll pick up some rendering time because the guys will be like, no, this is too cool. We can't not do this.
The trick is just to have Doctor Who geeks work on your show.
And then knock out all the good stuff and make them render the bad stuff. And then in order to keep themselves alive, they'll just forcibly render the
and don't pay them.
And don't pay them.
How I operated when I was an independent film.
I think that's how the BBC works basically at this point.
That explains it.
All right. So Stephen Fry, Brave New World, Ray Bradbury –
I think we've hit
James
all the,
Bond,
we've hit all the bullet
Solaris,
points.
Solaris, Sean Connery,
Laughlin.
We Vendetta. Did we mention that already?
Vendetta, Alan Moore.
Put these all in a shaker.
Mix well.
Serve.
Chilled.
Serve 12.
Chilled over ice.
So
with a pound of lemon,
right? And then garnish with Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
All lemons.
Delicious podcast.
What's your favorite TV show of all time? Do you have
my
one?
My favorite television show of all time. Good God.
Well, actually, I think I got
yeah, you got mm-hmm. it? You got it?
I would probably go with actually a show that is in and of itself not science fiction, but is sort of an homage to it. Spaced.
I knew you were going to say that.
Sports Night is a close second.
Sports Night and Space
is my top.
It's not
science fiction, but it's a close second.
So
you're taking my top two.
Do you feel with Sports Night as I feel with Buffy, that I sort of love it despite the fact that at the end it wasn't as good? Because I thought the third season of Sports Night
No, there's only two.
Oh, sorry.
There's only two.
I thought it seemed like three. Because the second season was so bad.
There are some downsides to the second season in terms of plot lines, but the writing is still good.
The writing and the characters are still wonderful.
I thought the second season of Sports Night really misused the women characters and made them more kind of broad and shrieky than
I would agree to a certain extent, but I think I was so glad to have the laugh track gone from Sports Night that I overlooked
also,
a lot of
also
things.
There are fantastic – I mean, you have William H. Macy in an arc, which is – he's great.
Well, you know. His wife's on the show.
Yeah,
yes.
they have a great dynamic.
Yeah.
Like they have good chemistry for a married
couple. Well, the dialogue sparkled. So
that's the point.
But Spaced,
I think, with again, which is
and
a short lived
Simon Pegg,
Jessica Hines, Nay Stevenson, and directed by Edgar Wright, and of course Wright and Pegg and Nick Frost went on to make Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and the forthcoming, at some point, third part of what they call, I believe that grouping will be called the Blood and Ice Cream Trilogy, they have said, which has no particular, you know, there is no thread between them other than they thought, wouldn't it be cool to make a zombie movie? Wouldn't it be cool to make like a cop action movie? And I think the third one is like a doomsday movie of some kind.
Right.
Someday, eventually.
Will there be Zeppelins?
But Spaced, if the best part of it is if you manage to get – for years I just had the Region 2 British DVDs because I got into the show while it was still airing because I was living in the UK at the time. My friend was like, you have to see this show. And I was like, all right. I mean, okay. So I started watching it and I was hooked within an episode and went back and got like the first season of it and watched all of it. But the best feature on the DVDs is they have an homageometer, which you turn on and it's a subtitle track that tells you what all the references are to.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it's fantastic. I mean, there's a lot. I only get about half of them.
And that's on the Region 1 DVDs?
I believe that is now on – they went back because originally it was a feature on the second series DVDs. And then when they made the box set of
the whole season, they went back and did it
for the first season.
The same thing's on – Shaun of the Dead. On Scott Pilgrim, Edgar Wright's third film.
Yeah.
Yes. That points out all of the in-joke references in that film as well.
That's a good movie.
I've thought of my favorite TV series.
What's your favorite TV show?
Well, we're out of time.
Is it going to be the Happy Little Trees guy?
No, the
oil painting show?
This is going to be the strangest.
that would be awesome. It's like, I like the Happy Little Trees.
Wait, I'm going to try to pick, like can we all guess? Can we all take a guess?
I think you should guess.
Let me hold on.
The Funky Phantom?
No. I think you should guess.
CPO Sharky, starring Don Rickles?
Harsh Realm, the failed Chris Carter series after the X-Files.
You know, I really liked Harsh
Alfred
Realm.
Alfred Hitchcock.
It had a terrible pilot.
Oh, also good.
The pilot was bad, but Terry O'Quinn is like a Banana Republic dictator in virtual reality.
That's right.
World. That's awesome. I love that show. That was a shame it didn't make it.
D.B. Sweeney, right?
D.B. Sweeney.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Sorry.
Tie between Rockford Files and Smack the Pony.
Really?
I would say. Rockford Files is my youth.
Those are
Smack
very disparate.
Pony.
I don't know what Smack the Pony is.
It's a
Smack
British,
Pony,
yeah. British show.
Incredibly funny. British sketch show. You have to say it was like the female heir to Monty Python. It was extremely absurdist. They were skits with no connecting material. Talented performer.
Sarah Alexander from Coupling.
Oh.
I believe
it
was
Kate Islet, I think. Isn't that who it is?
The blonde Susan.
Oh, yeah, Susan. Is that Sarah Alexander? Oh, I'm sorry. Sarah Alexander. Yeah,
she
was a featured player. There were three main actresses whose names I could not tell you. They show up all over the place. One was in Clatterford, this great short-run British TV series created by the woman behind Absolutely Fabulous, Jennifer Saunders. Jennifer Saunders, who, if you start talking about Jennifer Saunders, she connects to all other British television.
Including Stephen Fry.
They all connect.
They all connect. It's true, but she's done a lot of
As my wife and I joke, there are only 10 actors in the UK. Mm-hmm. So when you see a BBC thing, you're like, hey, it's that guy.
It is an island.
And they're all in Harry Potter.
Actually, they're all in The Young Ones, just about. At one point, many of these actors were all in
The
Young Ones. You go back and you watch the episodes.
Oh, man.
The Young Ones also favorite. You go back and watch The Young Ones and you see all these British actors who grew up and did other things, and they're all in there in cameos.
I could
times.
Actually spend an entire podcast just talking about my
British
favorite TV shows,
yeah.
including
yeah,
right. British shows.
Well, that could be a future show. So Rockford Files, Smack the Pony.
Rockford Files was my dad's favorite TV show. And it is, and going back and watching it, it is a great show.
Yeah.
And they tried to remake it, and they made a pilot with Dermot Mulroney, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a total flop, and they didn't pick it up. But there's a rumor that they're trying to remake it. And what everybody wants to do is cast Josh Holloway, who was Sawyer on Lost.
Oh.
And you know what? Watching him on Lost, especially when he did his like Dharma Initiative jumpsuit kind of persona. He
Jim
was like
LaFleur.
Jim LaFleur.
Yeah.
He is the right guy to be Jim Rockford. He is cool and he's kind of laid back. And that what you want that because that was what was great about James Garner as Rockford.
Theme song to Rockford Files. What's playing? Is it a Moog? What plays the theme song?
It's some crazy synthesizer. Mike Post.
That's right.
Yeah, Mike Post. It's the man who brought us all of those theme
Post
songs.
Post and Carpenters. Carpenter themes.
Yeah. All right. Those are great.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great. Well done. Job well done, Glenn.
I saved myself, redeemed myself at the end.
That's right. We won't kill you now. You'll just slowly suffocate.
Yes. No shallow graves for Glenn tonight.
Ren, you have a favorite you want to throw out there?
They go back and forth between Sports Night and Space, too. Uh-huh. But yeah, I know. That's the fault of me speaking last.
Wow.
Sports Night, I think, remains my all-time favorite just because, yes, As a television show, it had its flaws, but I love the characters. And the beautiful thing about Sports Night is there is a quote for every occasion.
Right.
There's not very many television shows that, I mean, have only run for two seasons. But by and large, for any situation that I've been in my life to date,
there's a Sports Night quote.
And it's always funny. And, you know, the characters are just fantastic.
I have 2 degrees of separation in Josh Molina. I have been in the same room with him.
You.
All right. Was it a podcast room that was slowly suffocating you to death?
But have you met Stephen Fry?
I was hanging. I met Rick Moranis. Spent some time with Rick Moranis once.
Fancy.
But yeah, so close.
Not
so
Stephen Fry
close.
By any.
You know an interesting thing? I was actually making a list of my favorite television shows and television shows I needed to watch a couple weekends ago. Yeah. Well, no, because
like
I had a huge Hulu queue.
I keep trying to make my top five list and I can't
figure out what number five is. Well, because I was trying to
–
a friend of mine was asking me what my top five television shows were. And I was like, Sports Night, Spaced, West Wing, and then I stopped at three.
Bit of an Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah,
Sliders?
Only a little bit.
Sliders, of course.
But no, I mean,
and Riptide.
Josh Molina has a guest shot in Sliders. That's
I realized that I had to split it up into two categories at one point because there are best overall television shows, and then there are best seasons.
Oh yeah,
where the overall series is terrible, but specific.
I can
seasons
make an entire list that's just. Top 10 TV shows that were canceled before their time.
Since this is a geeky podcast,
I'll say there's a great book called What Happened to the Hall of Fame. I think I might have mentioned this before. I'm not sure. By Bill James, the man who invented sort of baseball statistical analysis. And then he did the Historical Baseball Abstract. And he has this concept of there's career value and peak value. And it's true. When you're judging a baseball player, a Hall of Fame, are they a Hall of Famer or not? That's the question is, do you pick the overall career that it's like, well, over 20 years, he was really good. Or do you say, well, he only played for 15 years and he was really kind of mediocre for some of it. But when he was good, he was fantastic. And TV shows are sometimes like that, mm-hmm. too,
yeah.
where,
yeah.
you know, like Buffy is my favorite show of all time. But the fact is, if they hadn't made the last 2 years, I'd be okay with it.
My wife and I were mm-hmm. huge fans of that 70s show. It was very, very funny. It was, you know, it was our childhood. It was great. And sorry, my childhood, I should
right.
say, in this room. And I'm sorry. And I'm never the oldest man in the room, but today. So it was a great show for the first few seasons. And we turn on whatever the last season of that 70s show is on. My wife and I start to watch it. And we're like, did they kill all the writers? What happened?
And
the actors are standing and they're moving like marionettes.
Sitcoms have this usually harder, I think, than dramas mm-hmm. because there's –
Well, their writing staff changes.
Well, and also just because it's hard to laugh and you have a certain set of characters and you play out all the scenarios, right? And so many shows, you know, basically jump the shark because you get them into more and more far-fetched scenarios.
And when Mork and Mindy –
Jonathan Winters came
exactly.
and they had a baby.
Yeah.
Well, there's always that was horrific. I mean, there's always the annoying neighbor next door problem, which in what's funny is you can tell by this there's always an annoying neighbor next door
Mr.
introduced
Bentley.
At some point.
Mm.
But sometimes there's some shows you've watched where the annoying neighbor next door is on the first episode. It's a great sign of doom.
Yeah.
The Bob Newhart's third sitcom, for instance, the one where he was a cartoonist.
Bob.
The annoying neighbor, I don't know if he was a neighbor, but the annoying character was in the first episode. You're like, okay, it's not going to last. And it did not.
There are television shows where the annoying character slowly gets redeemed over a series of episodes, though.
And then there's the fourth season of Coupling, which also should never be.
There's a fourth season.
This
no,
podcast
no,
is over.
No.
It resides with the Matrix sequels and Pirates of the Caribbean
anyway,
sequels.
My point is that I really agree with you that you have to balance the list of like the ones mm-hmm. that really when they hit it were at the – and if you make one list, you just have to figure out how to balance those things. So for me, I've got Buffy at number one, 7 years, five of which I think were kind of peak value. And then the last two, the musical episode was great. But otherwise, I actually – not to spoil it for everybody, but the end of the fifth year has a really nice – endpoint that actually would have been a good way to end the show. And then they went to UPN and did two more years. My number two show, which for a long time was the number one show, was Max Headroom. And that's a show that lasted 12 episodes. And,
yeah, well, that's easier in some ways, right? Because they burn out before they get to
Firefly, right? Yeah.
Or Twin Peaks.
Wonderfalls.
Twin Peaks had
a great year and then a really fall apart year.
Yeah, one of my favorite shows of recent years, another great show that is like half homage, is a show, a not very appreciated show called The Middleman, which ran on ABC Family.
And that was like 10 episodes.
Yeah, and it's but it's fantastic and it's great and it's this huge like sci-fi reference show. Everything in there, like every episode is a joke about some aspect of science fiction
or whatever. Every single one. And Natalie Morales,
who is right now
on Parks and Recreation.
Which is also great.
Yes, and she is, I don't know why she's not in more things.
She is extremely talented.
Because I actually declared that on Twitter the other day and she wrote me back and she said, thank you. Because I was like, why is Natalie Morales not in more stuff?
Universal,
because I saw her on Parks and Rec.
Universal actor response is, please talk to my agent about that.
Well,
and
yes.
all producers.
Well, she was on this huge kick for a while. I followed her on Twitter for a while, and we had one or two conversations. But she was on a huge kick to try and get on Doctor Who when they got here.
Oh, yeah.
And she was like hammering it on Twitter because she is a huge Doctor Who fan.
No,
that was not a bad idea.
She's really good. And the guy, Matt
Keisler.
Yeah.
He was perfect for that role.
And he plays villains a lot. And I saw him in something where he was
Dollhouse.
A villain. And
he's
My wife and I went, Middleman, no.
Yeah, because he's the perfect clean-cut all-American Boy Scout.
No,
and it's like you can't have him play the bad guy.
That was a great show.
That was
a great show on the wrong network.
My favorite,
on the ABC Family.
And one of my favorite guest starring of that show was Kevin Sorbo. Who plays the former middleman from the 60s,
it's basically the idea. Austin Powers.
He's the guy, so the middleman is the guy who like deals with all the like aliens and zombies and werewolves and demons and all of that. He's the one guy, and so there's always one. It's like passed down, and Kevin Sorbo plays the older middleman from the 60s who had been like cryogenically frozen so that he could come back and fight his arch enemy. And of course, he plays like he's got like the swinging bachelor pad and like this great like blazer he's wearing, and he's just great.
Kevin Sorbo is a very self-aware cheeseball.
Oh, he's great.
Marvel Saturday. He doesn't care.
Andromeda was one of my favorite guilty pleasures growing, like watching on Saturday.
Oh, Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda.
Yes,
I try to watch.
You
that.
Know, I watched. I the first season of that was actually not too bad. And the idea, you know, what's interesting about that show? I can't believe we've gotten to the point where we're talking about Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda here. But the interesting thing about that show was if you view it as a coded kind of response to Star Trek, as an anti-Star Trek, because the whole premise is basically there's a guy, he's a starship captain, he's the United Federation of Planets, he's going around from planet to planet to stitch everything together in their happy organization, and then he gets too close to a black hole, goes ahead in time like 1,000 years, and when he reemerges, all civilizations have been destroyed and everybody's at war and he's a man out of time and all of the people he knew are dead. But it's worse than that. The whole Federation has like collapsed apart. And he's kind of screwed. And I mean, it is this great anti-Star Trek kind of thing. And then it got really cheesy.
I would actually say I kind of dug the other Gene Roddenberry show after his, I think, posthumous, which is Earth Final Conflict, which is kind of a cheesy show, but if you view it, again, it was syndicated kind of like Andromeda, but if you view like the first season, it has one of the most interesting things because they kind of kill off the main character at the end. But it's basically – it takes place in like modern day and aliens basically have showed up on Earth and like – ostensibly, it's kind of like
is that with the androids?
No, it's kind of a little bit of a V angle
there are aliens here,
and they're kind of like maintaining like, oh, we're nice and happy and here to help you out,
right.
But like they have an agenda, but it's better than
of
V.
Of course they have an agenda.
Oh, you're talking about Gene Roddenberry's Earth Final Conflict.
Anyways, it's kind
you're
of
thinking of Earth.
I thought that was
an
interesting
yes.
show and had some interesting dynamics. And
I was
again,
thinking of the short. There was a short run TV series. I was confusing that with
Earth 2.
Earth 2. Wow.
There we go.
Wow. I can still smell it from here. Holy cow.
You know, Steven Spielberg. Okay, so we're just burning
this
through.
This podcast will never be over.
Well, it will be, but we'll have used up all our topics for every other
future one.
Well, no. Yes. Well, it's
5 minutes of oxygen.
This is in the future, there will be a pill that is concentrated your entire meal. An entire steak will appear in this tiny pill.
Well,
that's this podcast. It's a concentrated – it's like a month's worth of podcasts jammed together into one inedible pill.
I have one.
The size of your head.
This is why we can't have more than two members of the Incomparable in the same room with
each other at any one time.
Exponential.
This is what being in a room with us is like on a regular basis.
If there were five.
Does anyone pick? 20 hours. Does anyone picture Scott McNulty sitting in the corner just going, "I hate you all"?
How can our loved ones?
Well, he'd be reading his collection of 53. Kindle, so he'd be completely occupied.
No, Steven Spielberg, you mentioned Earth 2. Steven Spielberg is like the guy who can't make a good TV show, isn't he?
Yeah.
He comes in and he brings his money and he does these things. It's like,
he also puts his name on all
sorts
of movies that are
terrible. Do you
remember
Steven Spielberg presents Taken? Do you remember that? That was like the 12-hour sci-fi miniseries wherein nothing happens.
Yes.
Although my favorite part of it, it was aired right before Christmas and you could very easily read the name of the show and misread it as that Steven Spielberg's presents were taken. Like, no Hanukkah for you, sir. No presents for you.
To be fair, he's got a show coming out.
Well, it's Terra Nova.
We'll be sure not to watch it.
Terra Nova, which is getting the Glee treatment on Fox, which is they're showing the pilot.
It's a musical?
Yes.
About dinosaurs.
It's all Journey songs.
I would watch that. About dinosaurs.
Cop Rock, I maintain, was well ahead of its time.
Thank you. You get points for – if only I was awarding points, you would win.
Boom.
Terra Nova is premiering in May, and then they're not showing any more episodes until the fall. But it is this like –
love that. That's always a sign of good, right? Like,
yes.
check this out.
It worked for Glee. That's the thing, is it worked for Glee. They did the first episode. It became a phenomenon. People like were really stoked. And so when it came back, everybody already wanted to see it and it worked. So they're going to try it again. It's like you're right. You'd think that they were kind of burning it off, but they actually want to build a buzz around it. So I hope the pilot's good. Otherwise, they're going to be canceled before they air.
I mean, my favorite story about that ever remains David Lindelof of Lost. Somebody asked him, does it freak you out?
That's my number three show, I think.
Does it freak you out that people are – this was before Lost had started to air. Like it was sort of, you know, airing in the fall. And someone asked him, does it freak you out that there are already petitions to save your show before it's even aired? And he said, you know, I'd like to flip that on its head. Like, they should have petitions to kill off shows that have been around too long. Like, this is actual – I don't think it's a verbatim quote, but he basically said, if there were a petition to kill Seventh Heaven, I would sign that.
No, it's just funny that he gets this – he has this kind of clout, and yet the shows that he has made have all been, like, high-profile, big-budget and
– I mean, when you're Steven Spielberg, you put your name on a lot of things, and a lot of them
breakfast
don't
cereal,
go well, right?
Rat poison.
Steven Spielberg's rat poison crunch.
Steven Spielberg's famous rat poison. You know, there was a movie called Young Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
And
famous for its Stephen Fry's lack therein.
The first 3D animated series, the guy who comes out of the stained glass window.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, that movie scared the crap out of me as a kid.
My old housemate's
thesis advisor was the guy who was responsible for that.
Do you know people who know everybody?
I do. I'm 2 degrees away from everyone in this room.
2 degrees of Glenn Fleischman.
I don't know you, but I know people who know you.
That's terrifying.
Stephen Fry, everybody.
So,
Stephen Fry.
Stephen Fry is a lovely, lovely fellow.
I'd like to dedicate this podcast to the memory of
my friend Rips with you all. I like and respect Stephen Fry enough that I hope he never listens to this.
This next song. That is, so anybody have – okay, that's
in
the –
in a world where one man
that covers
is the subject of a one-hour podcast.
That seems like 2 hours, but is only one – time dilation in effect here, clearly.
It's right. You'll let it at 95% of this.
This is going to just be a dial tone and a spoiler horn.
No fake duck calls.
That's it. Nothing but a dial tone and a spoiler horn.
Beep, beep,
it's spoiler
beep.
Horns all the way down. And, well, dear listener –
you've squandered another perfectly good hour.
Dear listener. Singular.
Dear listener.
I like that it implies that there's only one.
Yes. Dear
our
listener.
Our sole listener.
As we know from Scott McNulty, not even his wife listens to this podcast.
No. Well,
good
who
for
can blame
my
her?
My wife
good
does not listen to this
no,
podcast.
No. So dear listeners, plural, all both of you, count yourself lucky you weren't here. While we recorded this.
While we suffocated. A fly on this wall.
Yes.
A dead fly.
A dead fly.
The flies didn't even make it out. This is what it's like when you get us all together. Boy, was this a good idea. Until next time, for Dan Morin.
Thanks, Jason.
Say something, Dan.
You're welcome. This podcast is now over.
Glenn Fleischman.
Stephen Fry.
Serenity Caldwell.
Sports night forever.
For our audience. Thank you, audience. Do you have anything to say?
He's waving.
For
that works great on a podcast.
That is the best. Until next time, this is Jason Snell thanking Stephen Fry. Good night, Stephen Fry, wherever you are.